In this set lecture, in this section of the course. Well, obviously clustering, but could you be a little more specific? What problem are we trying to tackle? I spent a lot of time motivating last class, so come on. What? Why? That's a solution. What's the problem? We want to discover structure in unlabeled data. Now, why is that useful to us as pattern recognition engineers or scientists? Right. That's we can hopefully build some classification machines that don't require the use of expensive hand-labeled data. Alternately, we might be interested in what structure is discovered. And we talked about a number of different ideas why this might be a useful thing to us. And then what was the general approach that we spent most of the class on last time? I see blank faces. So, if you had experience in clustering, you would probably, at this point, be used to these non-probabilistic methods for clustering, like what we're going to talk about today, k-means clustering. But a more general approach to clustering, and instead of simply trying to sort the data into classes, a more general approach to clustering is to use this mixture model, where every data point has some probability of being associated with every class. And so we talked about that last time, and then we actually talked about it in the context of Gaussian mixture modeling. And we talked about ways to estimate the parameters of the Gaussian mixture model. All right, we're going to one of those days. So we talked about ways to estimate the mean, for example, of the distribution. Now, this one of the things that I keep seeing in this class is the confusion between the general approach and the Gaussian-specific approach. So when we write an equation like this, where we show a mean, this derivation was with respect to a Gaussian mixture model. When we write an equation, and that's why we're essentially calculating the mean, because the mean is a important parameter. It's a sufficient statistic for the Gaussian distribution. But in general, if, for example, I asked you on an exam to fit the data to a non-Gaussian distribution, you would use the more general form of the model, just involving the probability distributions themselves. And then you would have to derive some kind of equation to estimate the parameters of the model. If there are triangle distributions, for example, you'd have to worry about the mean of the distribution and the slopes of the triangle and those kinds of things. So try to remember as we go through this material the difference between the general solution and the Gaussian-specific solution. We spend a lot of time talking about Gaussian-specific solutions only because those tend to be tractable. So last time we talked about a technique that will allow you to, from the data, estimate a Gaussian mixture model, and as you iterate on that model, you can get pretty, you know, closer to the true underlying model. Now, also remember in this course, I know people sometimes say, well, you know, if I work more problems, I'd understand the material better. Well, again, you know, you're free to do that. With these extra credit problems, you can work extra problems and get credit for it. What could be better? Except you may not have enough time to do that. So whenever you see a topic that you're interested in learning more about, we can create a little assignment for you that will let you work that and get extra credit. So if you do 10 of those, you could actually get like an A in the course. Now you have to take the exam. So I wouldn't necessarily say you do that many of them, but so, and clustering is one of the fun things to play with because it's very visual, and we'll run the Java applet today and look at some of that. So if we previously, on the previous slide, we talked about We talked about assuming only the mean vectors were unknown, and then we derived an expression to re-estimate the mean, much like we did when we derived maximum likelihood estimates for the mean. But in general, when you're dealing with clustering, not only are the means unknown, but the covariances are also unknown. And then the prior probabilities of the classes are also unknown. And that's a very interesting and important issue because, and we'll demonstrate this with the Java applet, but in a nutshell, if I give you these two data sets, and I ask you, what's a good model for those data sets? What are you going to tell me? And now we have to worry about the means, the covariances, and the priors. Two classes. And what? Gaussian on each. Okay. So how would you estimate the mean? The mean might be the center. And how would you estimate the covariance? Well, you'd compute it, right? And what would it? How would we graphically represent that? Right. So we'd get some kind of ellipse. Hello. All right, it's going to be one of those days. Actually, that gives me a chance to redraw it with a little more. So, we'd estimate the mean. We'd estimate the covariance. And what about the priors? I'm sorry? Why? You don't have any information about that? Do you? You could estimate, exactly, you could estimate the prior by taking the number of data points here divided by the total number of data points and estimate the prior here, 1 minus that or the number of data points divided by the total number of data points. Now, that's something that so what we just described is something that you could have probably done before you took this class, but I hope now you understand some of the questions that that approach creates. What's one of the big questions here from a probabilistic point of view? In what sense? Okay, and why, looking at that data, might you be concerned about that? Well, sort of, but what can you tell me about the amount of data used to estimate this class versus the amount of data used to estimate that class? There's what? There's a lot more here. Now, If in fact this class is, let's say, four times more likely than this class, as you're drawing points at random, you're going to get a lot more samples of this. So this inequity is not going to go away if the prior is such that that bigger class is four times more likely. And remember, the prior is not simply the amount of space here. The prior is the number of related to the number of data points. On the other hand, this could be just some rare event that at the particular time you drew this data did not occur, but could occur if you drew that data tomorrow. So this is the risk generalization, all this kind of stuff we worry about, that those simple estimates that we just described don't really take into account the probabilistic nature of this data. On the other hand, if we're allowed to play around with the variance, if the variance is unknown, you could easily, an alternate solution might be a single distribution that has a bigger variance. If you were doing some kind of numerical optimization, it could very well converge on a solution like that. And you'll see that a lot when you do Gaussian models of this kind of data. You look at the data and you say, well, I know it should turn out a certain way, but then you'll run your numerical optimizer and it'll get stuck on some other solution that makes sense, but isn't as good from visual inspection. So if the means, covariances, and priors are all unknown, the ML principle yields singular solutions. If we only consider solutions in the neighborhood of the largest local maximum, we can derive estimation equations for the mean and the covariance. Again, we've seen these before when we talk about hidden Markov models, and the posterior then can be and the mixture coefficients, which we describe here. So. And our posterior model. So these equations, the general solution to this problem involves a nonlinear set of equations that have no closed form solution. But under certain assumptions, we can assume that we can derive equations that allow us to estimate the mean and covariance sort of independently. So we can estimate the prior. We can estimate the mean, and then we can use that mean to estimate the covariance. And we've seen these equations before. And then we have that, putting all those things together, that gives us a model for the posterior of each class. And what this model says is that with some probability, each one of these data points can be associated with either class. It's not a hard decision. You're going to get a non-zero probability for any I and any X sub K. Now, in a moment, we'll talk about clustering, which doesn't do that. Clustering is more of a hard decision type approach. At least the first example we'll talk about, K-means clustering. So let's talk. So let's think about this. We've got data distributed the way we just showed. And we can derive a very simple, very intuitive, yet very powerful clustering algorithm, and this is called K-means clustering. An approximate technique to determine the parameters of a mixture distribution is what we call K-means. K is the number of cluster centers for C clusters, and means refers to the iterative process for finding the cluster centroids. We observe that the probability P of omega sub I given X sub K and theta hat is large when the squared Mahalanobis distance is small. Suppose we merely compute the squared Euclidean distance, X sub K minus mu sub I squared, and find the mean nearest to X sub K and then approximate this probability in a simple way with one, if the closest cluster center corresponds to the correct class assignment for the data, and zero otherwise. So we can formally define the k-means clustering algorithm in this way. We have a data set we can call D, and we want to create C clusters. And so we're going to have C mean vectors associated with those clusters. Now, initially, we don't know what those are. We also don't know what the covariance of the clusters are going to be. So initially, we can simply choose those cluster centers. We can choose those in a number of ways. Last class, we talked a little bit about that. Normally, with k-means, you will actually just randomly seed those mean values, those means. Or you can actually pick some data points at random and assign those data points as the initial means. Or you can do what's sometimes called iterative splitting. If you have these data sets, you can compute a global mean, mu, and then you can take mu plus epsilon and mu minus epsilon. To get to your two cluster centers. Or you can do this for three or four, those kinds of things. It turns out that for k-means, there's a lot of heuristics that people do to do this. It's not terribly sensitive to the initial choice because the algorithm converges very nicely. So let's not worry too much about how you get the means, but you get some initial set of means, and then you begin an iterative process. You take the n data points in your data set D, and you classify them according to these means. So you simply do a nearest neighbor calculation. For every data point, you associate it with one of the C classes based on the mean that it was closest to. When you're done, you now have every data point associated with one class, one and only one class. Because remember, this is a hard decision. And then you take you recompute the means for each one of those classes based on the data that's associated with that class. You recompute the means, and then you go back and start this all over again. Classify the data, recompute the means. Classify the data, recompute the means. Now, what's going to happen is, if this all works well, your means eventually are going to migrate to the centers of the corresponding clusters. And we'll show that in a moment. And then you need some kind of stopping criteria. Typically, people will use a criteria which says that if the means are not changing, if the class assignments of the data are no longer changing, then you're done. Or sometimes you look at the percentage change in a mean, and if it hasn't changed all that much, you'll be done. K-means, as we'll show in a moment, converges very, very quickly. Within several iterations, you get a really good solution. And later we'll see this is one case of an iterative optimization algorithm. There are many ways to cluster, recompute the means, merge and split clusters, and stop. And that's, of course, been studied in the literature. This kind of thing was studied in the 70s. And, lots of different papers on great, better ways to see, to find the initial guesses, better ways to assign data to clusters based on the variances of the clusters and things, and more sophisticated iterative processes that allow clusters to be split as you're going when they look like they're too diffuse, and clusters to be merged so you can have merging and splitting, much like we had with decision trees and so on. But this basic algorithm is surprisingly powerful, and we've used this over the years for a lot of different things. Now let me extend the algorithm, talk about fuzzy k-means, and then we'll run a couple examples with this. Now we've talked about the fact that making these hard class assignments is not necessarily a good thing. It might be better to allow data points to be associated with multiple clusters. So in k-means, each data point is assumed to reside in one and only one cluster. We can allow fuzzy membership. A data point can appear in a cluster with some probability p of omega sub i given x sub k and theta hat. And we can minimize the heuristic global function, which we'll call j fuzzy, which is the sum of these probabilities over each class multiplied by the distance of the data point from the cluster center. So you're weighting that distance by the probability that cluster belongs in that class, and then you're also raising that to the b power just to it's often called a blending coefficient. And then you sum that over the classes. So this is a global measure that tells you how accurate your clustering is, how essentially tight these clusters are. The probabilities of cluster membership for each point are normalized, so we require that these things sum to one because we want them to be probabilities. And then you can derive re-estimation equations, which simply re-estimate the means using a pseudo-maximum likelihood approach, where you weight those means by your estimates of these probabilities. And those probabilities, in one implementation of this, can be inversely related to the distance of the data point from the cluster center. So this is one model that you can assign to this probability function. When in this model, the probability is inversely related to the distance. So if it's close to the cluster center, the distance is small. 1 over the distance is large. The probability is large. If it's far from the cluster center, probability is small, which makes sense. It's a nice heuristic. But we have to normalize so that these are true probabilities that range between 0 and 1. And each data point can be associated with each class with some non-zero probability. So this can be viewed as a form of soft quantization, and it fits nicely with our general notion of probabilistic modeling and EM estimation. So this is a nice generalization of k-means clustering, and if you remember when fuzzy logic was becoming really popular, these things came into fruition. It's also somewhat related to k-nearest neighbor type analysis. In fact, k-means and k-nearest neighbor are very similar in many ways. So let's demonstrate this. Okay, so let's start with something simple. Let's take two classes, two non-overlapping classes, and let's go ahead and select k-means. And let's then initialize. So what is the initial step in k-means going to be? Well, the initial step is going to be to guess what the initial cluster centers are. And we can, like I said, we can do that randomly, or we can do that in some kind of intelligent manner. So we display the original data. And, whoop, I forgot to set the... So we compute the means for each data set. I don't know exactly why I drew this there, but we will see what happens as we iterate. So we have these means. We assign data in each class. We basically take these means and we go through all the data and we assign the data to the mean that's closest to the data point. So in this case, since these classes are very compact, we're going to assign essentially all these points to this mean, all these points to this mean, and then we can actually use a maximum likelihood classifier based on these two means, and that's the straight line here. And when we do this, in this particular case, we get a classification error of 9.75%. It's gone through, once you have these two means, it goes through and collects it recognizes each one of the data points. Right? Yeah, the line, you would think the error would be zero, right? But I'm thinking we're not seeing, maybe there's one or two points that are not showing up well. Because it looks like it misclassified 39 out of 400 samples. But I'm not seeing where those samples are. But you'll see it when we iterate, you'll see what happens. So, in the next iteration, what do? Well, now we have each data point was associated with one of the cluster centers. So now we take all the data points associated with this cluster center and we recompute the center. And then we take all the data points associated with this cluster center and we recompute the center. And then we go back and reclassify the data. And you see that in that one iteration, we basically get the right answer and we get down to 0% error. So let's look at a more challenging example. But now I'm going to first run this example with only two cluster centers. So we're going to have a pretty high error rate because it looks like there's actually four clusters. So here's one cluster center. I'm guessing the other cluster center was somewhere in here. And we then go through this process of recomputing the means. So now you see what happens. The means start to move based on the iterations. And it seems like we've converged at a solution where we've got one mean here and one mean over here. Now, and that's to be expected because this data is not really well modeled by two clusters. So let's go and now select Okay, so now we have the four cluster centers. So the initial guesses are here and here, and I think there's one over here, and I didn't quite see where that last one was. Now we re-estimate the centers, and after the first iteration, we get four centers that are here, 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 and here. Okay, so they're pretty close, but they're not perfect. You know, they're not too close. So now we go through that same process, re-estimate the center based on all the data associated with that center, and you see now we get with that just that one iteration, we get much better solution. And now with another iteration, we get even closer. And we should then pretty much converge at that point. So the good thing about this algorithm is if you get the right number of clusters correct, you get a pretty good convergence. The bad thing about this algorithm is if you don't get the number of clusters correct, it's going to do a pretty good job of fitting to whatever number of clusters you choose. So one of the things that people will do is they will have some kind of global distortion function that will tell them how good this clustering is. And hopefully that function will tell you that order that four clusters is a much better fit for this data than just two clusters. Or sometimes we'll just do this experimentally. Now in the real world, when your data has significant overlap, sometimes you just find the number of clusters experimentally based on what seems to give you good performance. Now, there's an alternate version of this clustering that's known as the Lin-Buzo-Gray algorithm. And this algorithm is a little different in that what it tries to do is it first models the data as one cluster center. It computes a global mean of the data and calls that the first cluster center. Then what you do is you split that cluster into two clusters and you do an iteration of, you do k-means for two clusters. Okay, so we can show that. I guess for that it did four. So I think, let me go back. Let me refresh the screen for a second. I'm not sure why it's right. So you compute. The global mean, and you get one cluster. I'm not sure why it's jumping. Oh, yeah, there they are. Okay. So we started with one cluster. Then we split it into two clusters. Then we split those two clusters into four clusters. And then we can split four clusters into eight clusters and so forth. The reason this kind of an approach is popular, even though it's suboptimal, when you're done clustering, you actually have the clusters arranged in a tree structure, a binary tree, essentially. So you can actually compute the class assignments fairly quickly. with the k-means clustering that we showed previously, to associate a data point with each cluster, you have to essentially take the data point and do comparisons against all the clusters. So if you have 100,000 clusters, which I've tried to cluster data into 100,000 clusters, you sometimes do that in coding and quantization type applications. That's one, you know, every data point has to be compared against 100,000 clusters. That's very expensive. So with the LBG algorithm, the clusters are arranged in a tree structure, so you have that nice log 2 property on the number of comparisons you have to do to associate a cluster, a data point with a cluster. So it results in a less optimal clustering structure, but it gives you much faster computational properties. And then there's actually there's a neural network-based approach called the learning vector quantizer that takes that one step further and actually builds the clustering as a neural network so that you can use a neural network to actually do the data association. You can associate the data very, very fast with that approach. But the training process is more complicated because you have to essentially train a neural network classifier on the data. And then there are a lot of different variants. There's actually PCA-based clustering, and there's also kernel-based clustering and those kinds of things. So what we've done in this lecture then is to introduce the concept of unsupervised clustering. We've reviewed the re-estimation equations for maximum likelihood estimates of the mixture parameters. We've discussed Gaussian mixture modeling as an approach to clustering. And then we've introduced k-means and fuzzy k-means clustering. And then we demonstrated the performance of those algorithms on some real data sets. So next... Let's talk a little bit about Bayesian approaches to this kind of thing. So we talked at the beginning of class about the fact that estimation of the priors can influence your overall clustering. The k-means approach is not a probabilistic clustering in the sense that we don't take into account the prior probabilities of the clusters in the assignment of a data point to a cluster. And if you've learned anything in this class, you've learned now that by taking into account prior probabilities using a Bayesian approach, essentially, we should be able to do better than the non-Bayesian approach. So we can look at hierarchical clustering as an unsupervised Bayesian learning problem. So let's review a little bit about Bayes classifier. The maximum likelihood methods assume the parameter vector is unknown, but do not assume its values are random. Prior knowledge of possible parameter values can be used to initialize iterative learning procedures. So this is simply remembering that with Bayesian approaches, we not only worry about the likelihood function, we not only worry about the prior probabilities of the data, but we also worry about the probabilities of the parameter values for the model, right? And a non-informative Bayesian prior is to just assume that all possible values for the parameter model are equally likely, what we call a uniform distribution. But we've learned in this course that if we have knowledge about the parameters of the model, we can actually incorporate that and learn some of that in the Bayesian process, Bayesian estimation process. So the Bayesian approach to unsupervised learning assumes that theta, the parameter vector, is a random variable with a known prior distribution, P of theta, and uses the training samples to compute the posterior P of theta given D. So we assume the number of classes C is known, the prior probabilities for each class are known, the forms of the class conditional densities are known, typically we'll make those Gaussian, but the full parameter vector is unknown. We don't know the parameters of this model. Part of our knowledge about theta is contained in a set D of n samples drawn independently from this probabilistic mixture distribution, and we can write the posterior for the class assignments as a function of the feature vector and sample. So this is the posterior, which we compute the class assignment based on the feature vector X and the data set D. And we use for that a mixture model where we have the probability of the data vector X given the ith class assignment and the data set D times the prior of the ith class given the data set D divided by the sum of these overall classes. So the Bayes classifier tries to essentially estimate these functions. So because the state of nature or the class assignment omega sub I is independent of the previously drawn samples, we can write that P of omega sub I given D is just equal to P of omega sub I. And that allows us then to simplify this function by reducing these priors to just P of omega sub I. We can introduce a dependence on the parameter vector theta. So we can write that this likelihood function, P of X given omega sub I and D, is the integral of P of X comma theta given omega sub I and D. In other words, we're going to take a joint distribution between the feature vectors and the parameter vector, the parameters of the model, and we're going to integrate over that to get essentially just the marginal with respect to the feature vector. And this joint probability can in turn be written as another joint probability, the joint between X theta, the class assignment, and the data times the conditional of theta given the class assignment and D, all integrated over D of theta. This is just a fancy way of saying whenever you have a joint distribution, you can get the marginal by integrating out the other variable. But that requires knowledge of the joint distribution. And we don't often know that in a real problem, but we can sometimes estimate that. We can write that the selection of X is independent of the sample, so P of X given theta, omega sub I, and D is just P of X given theta and omega sub I. This should not be theta sub I. This should just be theta. Because the class assignment, when X is selected, tells us nothing about the distribution of theta, we can also write that P of theta given omega sub I and D is just P of theta given D. So we can now simplify this expression to write that P of X given omega sub I and D is just the integral of P of X given theta and omega sub I times P of theta given D times D theta. And our best estimate of P of X given omega sub I is obtained by averaging P of X given theta sub I and omega sub I over theta sub I. So this is simply saying that if we average, we can come up with the overall best estimate by averaging over all possible parameter values. And the accuracy of this estimate depends on our ability to estimate P of theta given D. So we can take this a little bit further, and then we'll eventually get to something that looks a little more familiar. So just sort of hang in there for a moment. So using Bayes' formula, we can write that P of theta given D is just P of D given theta times P of theta, just reversing the conditional, divided by the integral of P of D given theta, P theta, D theta. That's just another way of writing the Bayes' rule, where we have the likelihood, the prior, over the evidence. And we derived previously an expression for P of D given theta. We called this incremental Bayesian learning. We derived this in terms of a data set where we took n samples, estimated a model, and then we added another sample and estimated the new model in terms of the previous model. So this was an incremental Bayesian learning process. If P of theta is uniform over the region where P of D given theta peaks, so we can, and this is a assumption we've made before with Bayesian learning, that if we assume when we're close to the right parameters that all the parameter values for that model in that neighborhood are equally likely, then we can say P of theta given D peaks at the same location. And if the only significant peak occurs at theta equal theta hat, and if the peak is very sharp, then we can approximate this probability with this probability. So we can write that P of X given omega sub I and D can be approximated as P of X given omega sub I and theta hat. And therefore, we can then write that P of omega sub I given X and D can be approximated by P of X given omega sub I theta hat sub I times P of omega sub I over the sum of that over all the classes. So all this is really doing is justifying our use of the maximum likelihood estimate for the model parameters as if it were a true value of theta in designing the Bayes' classifier. In the limit of large amounts of data, the Bayes and ML estimates will be very, very close. So what we've described here is essentially P of theta has been obtained by supervised learning from a large set of labeled samples. It will be far from uniform, and if it will have a dominant influence on P of theta given D sub n when n is small. So if we have labeled data, we can actually estimate the distribution of the parameter values. But as each sample occurs, we then essentially sharpen this estimate, and in the limit, it will converge to a delta function centered at the true value of theta. That's just a way of saying that the process of this incremental Bayesian learning is guaranteed to converge if we're in the neighborhood of the true solution. Thus, even though we don't know the categories of the samples, identifiability assures us that we can learn the unknown parameter vector theta. Unsupervised learning of parameters, therefore, is very similar to supervised learning, but there's one significant difference. With supervised learning, the lack of identifiability means that instead of obtaining a unique parameter vector, we obtain an equivalent class. And for unsupervised training, a lack of identifiability means that even though this conditional might converge to P of X, the conditional of X given omega sub I and D will not in general converge to P of X given omega sub I. In such cases, a few labeled training samples can have a big impact on your ability to decompose the mixture distribution into its components. So we'll pick this up next class and talk about some specific implementations of this. But for the moment, we're just introducing this in a very general framework that everything we learned before for incremental Bayesian learning, which you may not remember, but we did cover that many weeks ago, can be applied to this problem of unsupervised classification much like we've applied maximum likelihood through something like the Gaussian mixture modeling. Okay, we'll pick this up next class.